Hey, welcome back to another episode of Parker's Pensies. Sorry for those who were listening earlier and didn't catch or it was too quiet. We got it figured out. Dr. Swinburne is back with us, and we're going to be talking about, are we bodies or souls? We're going to be going over an argument from Descartes for the existence of the soul and Dr. Swinburne's adjusted, amended argument and some personal identity stuff. It's going to be really exciting. So let's get right into it. If you want to support the podcast, support me on Patreon. Appreciate that. Links in the description. You can do a super thanks. And we're going to have some time for some Q&A. So if you guys, well, I'll give priority to super chats. Can't guarantee that we're going to get through all of them. But yeah, go ahead and leave a super chat. If I don't get to yours, I'm sorry, but consider it support for the podcast. So thank you for doing that. All right, here we go. Richard, thanks so much for making this happen again. I appreciate it. Can I hear your volume here?
Yeah.
There we go. All right, perfect. Well, people didn't really hear your first answer to the first question I asked, which was, you know, why'd you get into philosophy of mind from philosophy of religion? Yeah. Can you help us with that again?
Sure. I'm interested in all big questions about the nature of reality and what we can know about it. So naturally, I'm interested in what human beings are. Are they just bodies? Are they brains? Are they souls or whatever? But this is this issue is relevant to the philosophy of religion in a big way. Most theistic religions believe in an afterlife. That is to say, they believe that after our death, we shall live again, either on this earth or on some other environment. And that whether that is logically possible depends on what we are. If we are just bodies, then that is not logically possible because, or at any rate, for most of us these days, most bodies of the dead people are burnt in crematoria. Mm-hmm. And the flames of the crematorium turn a body into a chunk of energy. And the chunk of energy resulting from the burning of my body wouldn't be different from the chunk of energy resulting from the burning of your body, any more than if you put $100 into the bank and then somebody else puts $100 into the bank. There's no difference in the bank, into the same account, that is to say, in the bank. There's just $200 in the bank, but it's not dividing. It doesn't have bits that come from you and bits that come from me. There's just a sum. And likewise with energy, chunks of energy are the chunks they are, independent of where they come from. And so if we are just bodies, or the same applies if we are just brains, we couldn't have a life after death. Mm-hmm. But if we are souls, then we could have a life after death. Now, the particular version of substance dualism, which I believe, consists in the view that human beings have two parts, bodies, physical objects, and souls, immaterial things connected to the bodies during our lives. And it's our soul that makes us who we are. In life, it interacts with the body through our in virtue of having a soul, we can move our bodies and we can learn about the world. But when the body ceases to function and is burnt in the crematorium, or perhaps the bones are saved and the bits are dissipated, then the soul is still there. And it can be rejoined to another body or continue to exist without a body. And that there are no logical or metaphysical problems there. So one does need a theory of what humans are which allows the possibility of life after death if a central religious doctrine is to be maintained. The philosophy of religion is also interested in another question in the philosophy of mind, which is, do we have free will? Because if we don't have free will, then we're not responsible for our actions. And if we're not responsible for our actions, we can't be, as it were, blamed or punished justifiably for anything we do. And there will be a serious problem for any resolution of the problem of evil, because the problem of evil, of why God allows suffering, a central core of producing an answer to that, in my view, is that a lot of suffering is due to humans causing others to suffer. Mm-hmm. That's God gives us that freedom. But if we don't have that freedom, then clearly, why does God, what's the point of God making us suffer if we're, it's not our fault? Or even if natural evil is, evil of diseases and so on, is not our fault. Nevertheless, if we have free will, we have a choice of how to react to it freely. And therefore, if we have free will, we are largely responsible and have the opportunity to make ourselves do right actions or do wrong actions. And that is a major part of the answer to the problem of evil. So the right answer to these questions of whether we have free will and what we're humans alike is crucial for the philosophy of religion, and that is a major reason why I'm interested in them. Mm.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So I'll just point the audience to Mind, Brain, and Free Will, another great book by Richard Swinburne, and Are We Bodies or Souls? That's the one that we're going to be talking about today, where he goes in a little bit deeper on Descartes' argument for substance dualism. So I have a slide of Descartes' argument, and I thought I could just lay it out for us here. So Descartes' argument for the soul goes, premise one, I am a substance, which is thinking. Two, it is conceivable that I am thinking and I have no body. Three, it is not conceivable that I am thinking and do not exist. And then what Richard Swinburne says, what he calls Descartes' lemma is, I am a substance, which it is conceivable can exist without a body. And then we derive this conclusion, I am a soul, a substance, the essence of which is to think. Now, Richard, I wanted to ask about the cogito argument and whether or not that's a different argument than this argument for the soul. So cogito ergo sum, I am thinking, therefore I exist, or I think, therefore I am. Is this argument the same as this? Is it related? Does the cogito come before this argument? Just any initial thoughts on that?
I don't think it's relevant to talk about this, actually. Okay. It is an argument. I argue from, Descartes argues from, I think, therefore I exist. And I suppose the way I've phrased the argument that you put in the handout, this is number three. That's to say, or rather, it's number one plus number three. Mm-hmm. It is not conceivable that I'm thinking and don't exist. If I'm thinking, necessarily, if I'm thinking, I exist and I am thinking. Mm-hmm. So it is connected, yes. Yeah. But I don't think there's anything wrong with cogito ergo sum.
Yeah.
That's clear. And assuming that being a substance is just being a constituent of the world, Descartes gives definitions of substance on different places, but he would, I think, be satisfied with the notion that substance is just a thing that has properties and one of the things in the world. Given that, then one and three are pretty obvious.
Yeah.
And it all turns on two. Do you want me to say why I don't think this argument works just as it is?
Yeah, you
one, in, one,
In the book, you give a minor and a major reason. Yeah. Do you have those on top of your head? Can you give those to us?
Well, the minor reason is what Descartes actually argues for is the formalization on the handout is my formalization of his argument. The conclusion, I am a substance, the essence of which is to think. Descartes interprets that as saying, I think he fills it out a bit more, the whole essence of which is to think, mm-hmm. Something like that. Where are we? That's the whole essence of the whole essence of which is to think. Mm-hmm. Now that entails that, well, if I'm not thinking, I don't exist.
Yeah.
And that's not very plausible. I mean, there is such a thing as dreamless sleep, and there's no need for Descartes to deny that, and he doesn't need to. All he wants to say is that a soul is a, or all you can get out of it, is that a soul is a, having a soul is necessary for my existence. Not that it's sufficient. The major difficulty, the minor difficulty, is the sympathy that he's trying to prove too much, that I wouldn't exist if I wasn't thinking, and there's no need for him to do that. I expressed the other point the wrong way around. What it shows is that the argument shows, at most, that I am, that having a soul is sufficient.
Not necessary.
Yeah. If it works. That is to say, if the second premise is true, it certainly works. I am a substance. It follows from 1, 2, and 3. I am a substance which, it is conceivable, can exist without a body. And if it's conceivable, then I'm understanding conceivable as entailing logically possible, in the same sense as logically possible.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm a substance which is thinking, and it's logically possible that I don't have a body, so having a body can't be necessary for my existence. And if it's not necessary for my existence, then I can exist without a body. And so long as I have a soul, I would exist, because if I'm thinking, I exist. And I don't need a body in order to think. It's not logically necessary for my existence that I have a body in order to think. And therefore, it's not logically necessary for my existence that I have a body, but it's, so long as I have a soul, that's sufficient. So that's sufficient for my existence. And I think that argument is valid. I don't think many people would wish to deny that unless they have a view of what conceivability is irrelevant.
Yeah.
But if they think that conceivability simply means logically possible, there's no, I think if that's what's meant, then I think the argument goes through. But of course, it doesn't show that I now have a soul. It shows that if I had a soul, and then I could exist without the body. But it doesn't show I actually have a soul. Mm-hmm. And that's where it doesn't go wrong. And therefore.
Yeah, so I have your amended argument as well on the next slide. Should we move to that, or do you have? Okay, let's do that. So you have this amended argument You soup up Descartes' argument for the soul. And premise one is, I am a substance which is thinking. Premise two, it is conceivable that while I am thinking, my body is suddenly destroyed. Three, it is not conceivable that I am thinking and I do not exist. And then the amended lemma is, I am a substance which, it is conceivable, can continue to exist while my body is suddenly destroyed. Four, it is inconceivable that any substance can lose all its parts simultaneously and yet continue to exist. And it looks like the conclusion got cut off. But the conclusion is, I am a soul, a substance whose essential property is the capacity for thought. Only essential property is the capacity for thought. Sure. Yeah.
Now, the difference here is what I am claimed to be conceivable is not just that I exist without a body, but that it's conceivable that when I have a body, e.g. now, I could lose that body and yet continue to exist. So this, if this happens, then whatever is necessary for my existence must continue between, if it's conceivable first I have a body and then lose it, if that was all there was to me, then I couldn't continue to exist. But if I have another part and that's the essential part of me, then I could continue to exist. And it's only if there's another part that I could continue to exist, because you can't, nothing can go on existing if all its parts are suddenly destroyed. And if the body is the only part, it couldn't, I couldn't go on. Logically, I couldn't. So there's all that difference in the world. And I can consider myself at any time, as it were, when I have a body, it is logically possible that now I could lose the body. Now, I'm using the word conceivable and logical possible interchangeably at the moment. We'll go into what conceivability is in a bit in a moment. And that surely is conceivable. And the one reason I give for this is the after death or near death experiences which some people have. It seems to them that they have temporarily left their body and are looking down on the body from above, and therefore it's not their body anymore. They can't control it, but they continue to exist. Now, of course, this may not be the correct interpretation of what happens. It may be that the person is having a delusion that this is what is happening, he's really just imagining it. But even so, we understand what he's saying. We understand what the claim is, and that's enough to make it conceivable. And therefore, if the premises of this argument are true, the conclusion must be true. So the issue always turns on premise two, as I've phrased it.
So I really like this argument. I don't want to dive too deep into this or get too off track, but I wonder if someone would take issue with premise one again. You in the book you mentioned Georg Lichtenberg, and he says, you know, all Descartes knows when he's thinking, he doesn't know that he's thinking. He knows that there is thinking going on. And you give this reply about substances and properties, which I really, really like, and I wanted to share that with the audience. So what do you make if someone says, hey, look, premise one, I'm a substance which is thinking, that can't be shown from the cogito, because all you can know is that there's thinking going on, but not that you are the one thinking.
Well, thinking, say, X, so-and-so, thinking is a property. It's a property that the substance has, as it were, there wouldn't be thinking, just as it's of course a property that lasts over a period of time, but it's a property all the same. It's like being square or brown or anything. A thing couldn't It couldn't be just that there is brownness. Something has to be brown. It couldn't just be that there is squareness. Something has to be square. And it couldn't just be that there's motion. Something has to move. And likewise with thinking. Thinking is a property, and therefore something has to have it. The minimum must be that Descartes is aware that someone is thinking, but that, of course, is not all he is aware of. He's aware of I am thinking,
yeah.
And his knowledge is greater than someone's thinking. It's more positive than that.
Yeah.
So I think that, into my mind, deals with that matter.
Okay. So then you, and I think you're right, and you flesh that out in more depth later in the book. You talk about different types of designators, and I think, Lord willing, we can get to that as well. But so you say that premise two is probably the one that people will find most contentious or will want to target. It is conceivable that while I'm thinking, my body is suddenly destroyed. So how do you motivate this? How do you get for the skeptic, I guess?
Well, the initial understanding of conceivability is simply that it makes sense. There's no contradiction in it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you can understand conceive in a subjective or an objective way. That is, objectively, to say something is conceivable is to say there is no contradiction in it. In a subjective way, it seems to me that there is no contradiction in it. Now, of course, it does seem to me, and it will seem to many people, that there is no contradiction in this if they can make sense of the sort of experiments that I've mentioned. But they may say, why should its seeming be evidence that it really is? And the quick answer to that is, everything we purport to know about the world starts from seeming. And if seeming isn't evidence that something is so, then we wouldn't know anything.
Yeah.
It only seems that I'm talking to you, and that's a very good reason for supposing I am. If it wasn't, if it had no, then where would we start from?
Right.
We must, as it were, trust our reason. If we can't trust an argument or see a contradiction or so on, then we're lost. And that being the case, the evidence that something is conceivable is that makes sense. We see that in the objective sense, it makes sense. We can see what it's saying. It doesn't appear to entail a contradiction. Of course, it may, 15 lines down an argument, entail a contradiction. But until that's shown, one has to assume that it does. And in that sense, it is conceivable, or at least it so looks. And off we go. And the objection which I devote most time in the book to considering is what used by objectors to it today, and that is, you don't know what you're referring to by I, and so you couldn't know what it is, whether or not it's conceivable that I'm thinking or not. Maybe I refers to my body, or maybe it refers to something underlying my body which I know not of. And that is the objection.
Yeah.
And that led to my distinction between informative designators and uninformative designators. An informative designator is one which, if you know what it means, you know what it refers to. And an uninformative designator is one, if you know what it means, you don't necessarily know what it refers to. I am arguing that it's an informative designator. And if it's an informative designator, then you do know what you are referring to. You know what you're referring to when you're using it in what I call ideal circumstances. That's to say, when you're rightly positioned relative to what you're talking about and you're not subject to illusion,
mm-hmm.
Your faculties are working properly. But when you are just thinking and aware of yourself as thinking, you know what you are referring to. You are referring to this thing that is doing the thinking, the thing that you're most aware of, because thinking has to belong to something, and you know what it is because you are directly aware of it. And that's what you are aware of. You couldn't. And in that circumstance, this is the ideal condition for the application of I, because you can't be subject to an illusion. You can't be really, well, I think I'm thinking. In fact, somebody else is doing the thinking and I'm not.
Yeah.
That's not possible. Your faculties are merely faculties of awareness of your own mental states, and therefore there's no possibility of an illusion there. You can't be mistaken about the immediate content of your mental life. Your faculties work properly, and there it is. I understand I because I know what it's referring to in ideal circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And I know what it's referring to in the sense that I know the necessary and sufficient conditions for being I in those circumstances. But knowing necessary and sufficient conditions isn't necessarily a matter of knowing a definition. It's having the ability to recognize when the word applies and when it doesn't.
Yeah.
That's what is the case here. I know in these circumstances, when we are talking about myself as a subject of thought, I know when it's true and I know when it isn't. And that's all there is to it.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to jump back on the amended argument and see how the amendments that you made can help you avoid your minor and major objections to Descartes' original argument. You said, you know, it's a good argument, but it only shows that you exist while you're thinking, and it's also it only shows that a soul is sufficient for existence but not necessary, and that's important. You want it to be sufficient and necessary, and you want to exist while you're not thinking, because we have dreams where we're not conscious, perhaps. Though Descartes would say now. So how does the amended amended lemma, the amended premise two, how does that help us avoid the major and minor reasons?
What I call the minor objection is simply to the way Descartes phrased premise one. Mm-hmm. That's to say, he thought what he says is, or rather, what he, sorry, the way he phrased his conclusion. His conclusion was that I am a soul, the whole essence of which is thinking. That implies that if I'm not thinking, I don't exist. There's no need for him to reach that conclusion. All he needs to reach is the conclusion that I am a soul whose only essential property is the capacity, and the word is capacity for thought. When we're asleep, we have the capacity for thought, because if someone wakes us up, we can think.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if we're a corpse, nobody can wake us up, so we've lost the capacity for thought.
Yeah, that's really helpful. So when you say, so only essential property is the capacity for thought, some people we'll want to push back on that. You know, there's feelings and there's all sorts of other stuff that that is essential to me. Even if I go along with you and say I'm essentially a soul rather than a body, and so I just wanted to get, you know, what do we mean by thought? I think in the book, yeah, you include other things.
Descartes himself says somewhere, and I quoted that he means by thought all the typical mental states. That's to say, intentions and feelings and so on. I could find the quotation, but he himself means that,
yeah.
And indeed I do. That is to say, what is essential for me is the ability to have conscious events, to be conscious. Mm-hmm. It may take the form of thought in a narrower sense of thinking about philosophy or something, but so long as it includes, it may take the form of performing an intentional action or having a sensation or a belief or a desire. It's the capacity to have mental events, being those to which the subject has privileged access. That is to say, I know better than anyone else. I may not know perfectly, but I know better than anyone else, or I can know better than anyone else what I'm thinking about, what I'm feeling, what I believe, and so on.
Yeah. Okay. So,
that's the first point. So he needn't claim that I don't exist when I am not thinking at all in that wide sense. All he ought to be able to conclude from this is that I'm a soul whose only essential property is the capacity for thought. Because if I have the capacity for thought when I'm exercising it, of course I exist, but that allows the possibility that I exist when I'm not exercising it.
Right.
And, but it's the issue is, it meets the two difficulties. The first difficulty being this is trying to prove too narrow a claim that I exist only when I'm thinking. All one needs to say is that so long as I have the, it proves that when I have the capacity for thought, I exist. But the wider thing is that the original argument did not show that having a soul was a necessary condition of my existence, only that it was a sufficient condition.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I love the your amended argument there. Just a peripheral question. When I'm a soul, a substance whose soul capacity or whose only essential capacity is for thought, is that soul synonymous with mind? Do you use those interchangeably, or does the substance, the soul, have a mind or something like that?
I avoid this word mind.
Yeah.
I explicitly say that because it could be used in innumerable senses. People are said to have a mind just because they can give an argument or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm using soul in Plato's sense.
Yeah.
It's a separate thing from me which constitutes my existence. It isn't a physical thing being something to which everybody has equal access.
Mm-hmm.
It is something to which I have privileged access, and indeed infallible access. It's what makes me me, but it's not a physical thing, but it is in temporary interaction with a physical thing, my body.
Yeah. Okay. That's really helpful. How about, this is another one that could be kind of bog us down into a morass, but is the soul, we're going to talk about personal identity over time and how the soul is so important for that. Is the soul the person, or does the person have a soul?
The body is part of me, of course, but it's not an essential part.
Mm-hmm.
There's the sense of I have a soul is just that the soul is a part of me. Of course, it's the one and only essential part of me, in my view, but it's a part all the same.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I have a soul.
Mm-hmm.
But for all the mental predicates, it is the case or rather for all the pure mental predicates, those that don't entail the existence of body, for all the pure mental predicates, it is the case that if I think, then my soul thinks, and I think because my soul thinks. If I have a pain, then my soul has a pain, and I have a pain because my soul has a pain. There's nothing strange about that. I mean, if I have a tattoo, I have a tattoo because my arm has a tattoo, but there's only one tattoo. Likewise with the relation between me having pure mental property and my soul having pure mental property.
I think that's helpful. That lets dualists avoid the too many thinkers problem that animalists run into. Yeah, that's really helpful. So on that note, then you argue that having a soul is necessary for personal identity over time. Is that the right language? Is that too strong? Or is it the best explanation? Or it is necessary?
It is necessary and sufficient for my existence. It's necessary. And when I discuss, as it were, the argument from neuroscience, all that shows is that having a soul is necessary. It doesn't show that it's sufficient.
Okay. You set up different theories of personal identity. You got complex theories, and then you have the simple theory. What distinguishes a complex theory from a simple theory? Can you just help us out with that?
Complex theory says that a theory of personal identity, by which we mean diachronic personal identity, what makes me or anyone the same person as a person at an earlier time or at a later time, a complex theory analyzes that in terms of having the same body or having the same brain or having same sort of memories, all of which are things that you can have to different degrees. Mm-hmm. You can have some of the same body or some of the same brain or some of the same memories. And they're complex in the sense that you have to have enough of, according to these theories, enough of the same body or enough of the same brain or enough memories and so on. And of course, they spell out what constitutes enough. And they usually say it's not merely having enough of this, but having the body or brain or mental life at the later time has to be caused in part by the mental life, brain or body at the earlier time. It's the degree, but I mean, causation is not going to be enough, is it? I could cause things to happen to your brain without in any sense it being my brain. So they all say, well, if you have enough of this, then that's what makes me at the later time. As opposed to the simple theory, which says either that person is or that person isn't, and this is not further analyzable in terms of any property or stuff which is capable of division.
Yeah. And you go on to motivate this with your Alexandra argument. It does so much work. It's really, really cool. Do you want to lay that out? Brain transplant?
I do it in terms of current neuroscience, but it would work if the neuroscience was a bit different. What the neuroscience is, our thoughts, feelings, our mental life are dependent on the operation of our cerebral cortex, the part of the brain that's on the top. We have a left hemisphere, the brain, and a right hemisphere, and they've each got cerebral cortexes. It's a very interesting neural fact that some people, unfortunate people, have had to have most or even all of that one of their cerebral cortexes removed in an operation called an anatomical hemispherectomy. This is done if in very acute cases of epilepsy. It's a way of dealing with it. Now, you might think that made a difference to the person. The interesting thing is, well, it does make some difference to their motor capacities. They can't immediately move both arms or anything like that. Mm. It makes little difference to their thoughts and feelings and so on.
Yeah.
So, as it were, one of these hemispheres is enough to have the thoughts and feelings and so on you do. Okay? But now suppose that one of your hemispheres is removed and the hemisphere is removed from some other person, and what was my left hemisphere is put in the other person instead of their left hemisphere and connected up to their body. Now, of course, this operation can't yet be done, and it may take many decades before it can be done, but there's no reason in principle why it can't be done. Because surgeons are now beginning to learn how to mend spinal injuries. That is to say, where somebody's spinal nerves have been cut or broken, and they can't move their arms and legs. And the neurons which make up a spinal tract are same sort of neurons as make up the brain. And if they can mend these, then they can put some other one instead of it. And so it ought, in theory, to be possible to replace a hemisphere by a hemisphere taken from someone else.
Mm-hmm.
It's not... hemispheres are fairly separate in the brain. They're connected to each other in the middle by a tract of nerves and one or two minor tract of nerves.
The corpus callosum or something,
yes,
right?
Yes, the corpus callosum. And there are, well, other connections, but I mean, it's not just cutting out a quite an arbitrary chunk of the brain or anything like that. So it ought, in theory, to be possible. Okay, but now suppose that other person has both their hemispheres removed and one of my hemispheres, the left, put there. That person, because all their thoughts and feelings are dependent on the hemisphere, will clearly claim to have been me.
Mm-hmm.
And I will claim to have been me. And in all respects... The extent to which each of, at least so it looks, each of us makes these claims, and there doesn't seem any reason for preferring one to the other.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you think there is, because the brainstem, as I've described this experiment, is the same in both cases, well, can suppose that both hemispheres are removed from me, and each of them put in a different body, so that, as it were, the brainstem is isn't at all the same. But that oughtn't to make any difference, because the brain, this is, doesn't seem to be essential for consciousness. And consciousness, what the content, it may be essential to being conscious, but what the content of the consciousness is depends on the cerebral cortex. So you get the situation of brain, half brain transplants, and that raises the issue of which, if either, of the subsequent persons is the same as the original person.
Mm-hmm.
And what is a complex theory to say about this? Well, the complex theory, I have to say, well, it depends on just whether they have more memories or whether they have a bit more of the brain or so on.
Yeah.
But problem is this looks extraordinarily arbitrary. 50%, 51%, 52%, how much do you need? It would be absurd to say that just because one of these guys has 51% and the other has 49%, this one is and that one isn't. That would be highly arbitrary. And they're not going to be exactly the same. There are certain things for which the left hemisphere is much more needed than for the right hemisphere, and conversely.
Right.
They're not going to be exactly the same. And it may be that what makes me, it's essential to me, is carried by the left hemisphere, it may be it's carried by the right hemisphere, but there's no way of finding out, since most of what is essential to my life of thought is carried by both hemispheres.
Yeah.
Account, and there are plenty of accounts in the literature of philosophers who thought of, says it's me if it has more of the brain, more of the memories, they sometimes add a clause, so long as the other person doesn't have very much or something like that, but it's highly arbitrary. And arbitrary if there's only one transplant to say it isn't me, and if in most of these cases there will be the possibility of a second person with an equal claim to be me, all the theories which analyze personal identity in terms of continuity of properties or stuff which makes the person that person are open to this objection.
Yeah, I love this objection, and I love thinking about like a set of triplets, and you take, you know, a hemisphere from this one and put in this one and this, and you can just keep shuffling them around. And I think it really draws out the argument well, that like it's not, the complex theories are insufficient for personal identity over time. The book, you do such a good job in the book, so I definitely commend this to everyone. I have a couple more tangential questions again for you. So folks, like read this book, because the treatment's really, really well done. But Richard, do you think that souls are they spatially located? Do they follow a certain amount of the brain if it's transferred? What do you make of that?
Well, who knows?
Yeah, right.
It's reasonable to suppose that if only a tiny bit of my brain is removed, and I go on behaving in the same way and so on, there's no reason to postulate that a different person is in charge, because it would be an arbitrary supposition to suppose that the mere removal of one bit, which makes no difference to behavior and so on, is going to make any difference to who is in charge of it. But when you get to the more extreme cases of changing brains and so on, the answer is, I don't know where I go. And that's just the point. That is the point, that I don't know. It doesn't follow from the description of what has happened in public terms, and nothing follows as to which person is me. But of course, the more the later person has memories similar to mine, and the more the later person has brain similar to mine, the more probable it is that that's me. But that's the most you can say.
Yeah, that's really helpful. So I'll ask two more questions, and while I do that, and while Richard is responding, folks, go ahead and put your questions in the live chat. Again, I will prioritize super chats because I can see them better, and because you're supporting the podcast. So so two follow-up questions as people are typing their questions in the chat there. One is about memories and near-death experiences. Sometimes when substance dualists talk about, I'm a substance dualist myself, but when someone's coming on to help me think through substance dualism, they'll kind of refer to the soul as if it's like a bare particular, or or yeah, the soul just has this the soul capacity, there's only one essential property, and that is the capacity for thought, right?
Yeah.
Does the soul, do you think the soul remembers things, or is it just this like this thing with one property that is just the capacity for thought? Like, do you know what I'm getting at there?
Yes, I do. And it's a very important question, this. I don't discuss that question in this book, that I do discuss it in Mind, Brain, Free Will. Mm-hmm. It's the view that, as it were, when we have memories and indeed the whole beliefs and desires which continue over time, whether the continuity is due to the beliefs, desires, and memories inhering in the soul, mm-hmm. or whether it is due to the brain being in such a state that it always throws up the same memories and desires.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. so long as that soul is connected with it. And they call the first view the categorical view, and the second view the dispositional view.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, I wouldn't wish to come down very strongly on either side in this matter, but I think there is reason for believing that the categorical theory is to some extent right. I mean, to some extent means, well perhaps some of these things adhere to the soul and others don't.
Oh, okay.
And the reason is this. Suppose you're going walking from A to B, and you know the route, and you take this turn and that turn and then this turn and that turn, and you take this turn and that turn and so on because of your beliefs. You believe that if I take this turn, I will reach this road, and then if I reach this road and go that way, then I'll get there. But you never think of this while you're actually walking, because you are familiar with the situation. You may be talking about philosophy to someone as you're doing the journey.
Yeah.
But the belief is influencing your conduct, but not merely when you're conscious of it, but when you're not conscious of it. That suggests that beliefs are pretty central things to you. How can I express it a bit better? No, I don't think I can express it a bit better. It is just that the beliefs of which you are conscious interact with the beliefs of which you are not conscious.
Mm-hmm.
They're both beliefs. I may, when I'm walking along, have certain beliefs which I am conscious of, is that I am talking to Jones, and therefore we need to go together, and so on and so forth. And that is interacting with my beliefs which are unconscious and directing the steps I take. Now, this is clearly our beliefs influence us when we are conscious
mm-hmm.
Of them. But this shows that our beliefs influence us when we are not conscious of them. And it would be strange if the way the beliefs influence us was different according to whether we were conscious of them and whether we are not conscious of them.
Yeah.
That doesn't solve it altogether, but it does suggest, because if you take the dispositional view, that as it were, they're not there until they're needed, until we're conscious of them, that has the consequence that, as it were, their influence on our conduct is very different from their influence of our conduct when we are conscious of them.
Yeah.
For example, when we are actually doing an argument from belief A to belief B. And for that reason, I do go along with the categorical view to some extent. Well, I don't think that argument's conclusive, but it does tip it in that direction. Mm-hmm. And of course, it would be more convenient for a religious view if the categorical view were true, because if we arrive at life after death without the original body, then we wouldn't have all the bad tendencies and all the memories of our evil deeds and so on.
Yeah.
With us, and it would seem, you know, why am I being punished or whatever?
Right.
Whereas if they inhere in us, then that makes sense. So that is certainly desirable for the religious view. I don't think it's necessary, because God would know, as it were, what the soul had done, but we wouldn't be aware of it. So what I think about that.
Okay, that's really helpful. I think also with NDEs, with near-death experiences, whether you take those to be vertical or not, like if you do, then there is some more evidence for the categorical view that like our memories inhere in our soul.
Oh yes, but I'm a bit doubtful about those experiences. Okay. I must say, but
yeah. Okay. All right. So last one for me, and then we're going to move to audience questions. And again, it's kind of a more speculative one. But as a substance dualist, Richard, do you think it's possible for humans to create artificial consciousness, which with similar qualitative experiences to ourselves?
Yeah. Well, the only evidence that anyone is conscious is that they have the sort of brain that we have. It's not enough to say, not enough evidence of consciousness to say they react in a certain way. You could have a machine which no one would think was conscious, made of steel and silicon chips, which if you stick a pin in it, it'll scream.
Yeah.
Also, you could, and the computer scientists are on their way to making one that would pass the original Turing test of talking to me for an hour. The fact that some machine reacts in the way that we do, because it's been made to, doesn't show that what's going on in the machine is causing it in the way that what's going on in us is causing us to behave in this way. So what we would want is evidence that the sort of thing is that's happening in the machine is that in the machine there's the that there is going on in the machine the sort of thing that goes on in our brains when we are conscious. Now, of course, this crucially applies to the case of animals. Invertebrates don't have our sort of brain, and for that reason, they may be conscious, but we've no good reason to suppose they are. They just react. Higher up the scale, we have very little reason, I think, to suppose that there's very much consciousness until you get to the mammals. But anyway, the point is, the argument goes, look, this creature has a prefrontal cortex, and things happen in that context of the sort that happens cortex, the sort that happens in us when someone sticks a pin in me. So probably that being is conscious. So as regards our making something, if we make something out of silicon chips, I don't see that which reacts in the right way. I don't see any grounds for supposing it is conscious. It might be. But if we made it out of bits of the sort of thing we may are made of, that's to say, if we brought it into existence not by a sexual procreation, but by a surgical operation which took bits from various dead bodies and stirred them up, then it might well be conscious.
Okay. So maybe we can hack into like the psychophysical laws that God set up to establish soul body connections.
Yeah, well, yes, I'm inclined to think there are soul body laws, but and this is the all important thing. Laws of nature are laws which say something of this kind with this sort of property will cause something of that kind with that sort of property. An arrangement of bodies with this sort of mass and this sort of velocity will lead to bodies with this sort of mass and that sort of velocity. And mixing this and that chemical substance would make a substance of that kind. But, and therefore, the laws of psychophysical laws would have the form of when a human fetus reaches this stage, then it produces, causes the existence of a soul. But it doesn't say it causes the existence of this soul. It doesn't say it causes me or anything else. Because what makes me is not anything ex is not analyzable further. And I argue that I have thisness, that is to say, instead of me, there could be a human being who had just the same life, same life history and so on, came into being the same way, but wasn't me. That also seems to make sense, and I can give a further argument for it if you want in a moment. But to say that is to say that souls has thisness. Now, souls aren't the only thing that may have thisness. It's a serious discussion in physics as to whether fundamental particles have thisness. That is to say, would the world be different if instead of a certain electron here, there was another different electron there? Would have all the same properties as the first electron, to be in the same place and so on, the same history. But could it be different? The normal answer in physics is no, because electrons don't have thisness. So any electron in that place with just those properties would be the same electron. Now it seems to me that isn't the case with humans. Instead of me, there could be a different one who was different just in the respect it was me. And if that's right, then then no scientific law could explain that, because scientific laws never deal with things that have thisness. They only deal with things in virtue of their properties, and the properties that of the person thrown up by my brain might be just the same. Features would be just the same as the properties thrown up. Even if it wasn't me who had these properties, but had this someone else. Once again, my argument for that is firstly from conceivability. We can make sense of this suggestion, but I could make a further point, but I'm concerned about your audience.
So thisness is like a it's an essential property to me. It's a quiddity or a hexaity or something where it's just it's mine. You can't have it, and that's it. You can't analyze it anymore. I really like that. All right, well, that's enough for me. I appreciate it. Those were really fun. Let's get to the first super chat here. All right, this is from Adrian. He says, "What do you think about hylomorphism views, hylomorphic views?"
This is the Thomist view, that what I consist in is having a soul, my soul, and having this body. That is to say that the body is not merely a body, but this body is necessary for me. I have to have both a body and a soul, and indeed this body. Now, and it's hylomorphism because on this view, the soul is the form of the body. That's to say, it's the way the body behaves and relays is matter. It's the way the matter behaves that forms me. It's the way that the matter that's me behaves in the sense of throws up thoughts and feelings and so on, as well as doing public acts. And that's what makes it me. Now, I think that is mistaken. But I think I better say what why the only version that the average Thomist will give you isn't really a hypomorphic view at all. Because it all hylomorphism dates back to Aristotle, and Aristotle said that what makes this desk the desk it is the matter of which it's made and the shape in which it's formed. And of course, that's so for stationary physical objects. It will also be so for physical objects which have properties of motion. What makes the car it is, it is partly the way that it will behave over time, and that's a property of it. So it's the matter of which the thing is made and the properties which are instantiated in it. And Aquinas thought that that's what makes me the person I am. But for Aristotle, properties are universals. That is to say, what makes the desk it is first that it's a desk, and being a desk is a property possessed by this chunk of matter. But then on this view, as adjusted by Aquinas, if one took that model seriously, then every soul would be the same. That is to say, it would have... its soul would be the form of humanity.
The universal form, yeah.
Yeah, well, not universal form, but the form of being human.
Yeah.
All humans would have the same form, and it would be their bodies which distinguish them.
Yeah.
But in that case, the soul would not be the form of this body. It's be the general form of humanity. And souls don't individuate by themselves. The individuation on the Aristotelian model consists in the chunk of matter, right? But Aquinas would accept, the hylomorphic theory would have to accept, that the soul can exist by itself. And what makes it it is therefore not carried by the body. Aquinas, of course, wants to say that the soul is not the whole person, but the mere admitting that our soul can exist without the body commits him to the view that identity is carried partly, at least, by the soul. And that gives him a view of soul which is utterly different from the notion that it's just a collection of properties. Furthermore, of course, in saying that, for Aristotle, properties can't really exist unless there are things in which they exist. Desks, the property of deskness doesn't exist except when there are desks.
Right. No uninstantiated forms, right?
Yeah. But the form, the soul, which is the form of body, the form of the body, according to Aristotle, according to Aquinas, must both be individual and capable of existing without the body. So it's a very, very strange form of Aristotelian soul, and seems to me that if it can exist by itself, if it can exist on its own and have, as Aristotle, as Aquinas wanted to say, a certain conscious life without without the body, then seems that a person exists without a body. Aquinas goes on about the souls of the saints in heaven are always praying for us and so on and so forth, but if the souls are praying for us, surely the saints are praying for us. And as used in a Christian context, it simply boils down to Descartes' own view, I think.
Yeah.
But of course, you could take it a little more seriously and say, well, what makes me me is really a form, if Aristotle says, and a form of humanity. And what makes me me is the chunk of the form of humanity being instantiated in this particular chunk. Mm-hmm. But that runs into all the problems of how much of this particular chunk
right.
that we were talking of earlier.
Yeah, complex.
If I lose an arm, it's still me. If I lose half a brain, is it still me? All those problems re-emerge.
Yeah.
Unless you suppose that the soul has individuated, has contains its own principle of individuation, and hence a simple view of the soul. And if you do that, and therefore allow that it could, that what makes the person it is not just the form or the chunk of matter, something else, then the hylomorphic theory begins to collapse into Descartes' view.
Yeah.
So my answer is Aquinas' view is really in essence the same as Descartes' view, only he's unwilling to admit it. But if you took it seriously as a hylomorphic view, it would be back with Aristotle, and that leads to all the problems we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I love that. And you did mention a bit of that in Are We Bodies or Souls, and comparing Descartes and Thomas there. So that's so great. They will run into, if you take it too seriously, the arbitrariness objection or the more than one candidate objection that we talked about earlier. All right, let's go to another question here. This is from Chad. What explanatory virtues does dualism have over panpsychism?
Let's have a look at panpsychism. Panpsychism says everything is conscious. Well, what earthly reason have you got to believe that? It's multiplying consciousnesses beyond necessity, to start with. To explain all the things around us in terms of... We know that we are conscious. Other people are very like us in the way they're constituted. Animals are somewhat like us in the way they're constituted. That's good reason to believe that they are conscious. But we have no reason to believe that desks and tables and chairs are conscious. Then, of course, the panpsychist says, well, it's not desks and tables and chairs. It's the atoms of which things are made that have consciousness. But that runs into the trouble about, well, okay, I'm conscious, so are the individual atoms of which I am made. They're conscious too. What's the relation between their consciousness and my consciousness? My consciousness can hardly be said to be the sum of these, because either I'm conscious or I'm not. And if you take a bit away, sometimes it doesn't make a difference to my consciousness, and sometimes it makes all the difference to my consciousness. So I think panpsychism has these two problems. It attributes to material objects consciousness when there's not the slightest reason to believe that they're consciousness of the sort that we have for believing other people and animals are consciousness. Mm-hmm. And secondly, it has the problem of explaining how both the stuff of which things are made each bit is conscious, and also the whole is conscious, and yet the whole's consciousness is not the same as the sum of the bits is consciousness. Because the bits are conscious on their own, as it were, when they're separate. So they're conscious, but I only have one consciousness. So both what I'm made of and me are conscious, and that does again proliferate things.
Yeah.
Without explaining how the one is connected to the other.
Yeah, yeah, that's really great. All right, we got one. Let's do maybe just two more here. Dr. Swinburne, what are your thoughts on causal closure arguments against substance dualism? And I'll note that you do talk about interactive dualism. You have a whole chapter in Mind, Brain, and Free Will. So I do recommend people grab both of these books and give them a thorough reading.
I'm not quite certain what you mean about a causal closure argument. I wonder if you could explain that.
Yeah. Maybe like a conservation of energy type stuff, right? So we have interactive dualism.
See, the causal closure of the physical.
Yeah, sorry. Yep.
Yeah. I don't think the physical is causally closed. I discuss this in chapter 6 of this book. Suppose that the physical is causally closed, you therefore only get the only causal interaction between the physical and the mental was not an interaction, it would be a one-way business from the brain to the soul. You thought that was the case, then how would you know anything about what had, how would you be able to rely on your memories? How would you be able to know what other people are telling you, etc.? Now, the way this works is like this. Suppose I do a certain thing today and I remember the next day that I've done it. How is this procedure? What's happening? Well, the normal view, and surely correctly, is that my doing it yesterday laid down some trace in the brain, and that trace in the brain caused it to pop up the next day. But then that is already postulating in stage one a downward action, an action from the mental to the physical. And if you think that doesn't happen, then why on earth should we believe our memories? Because they wouldn't be able to influence our present mental state. And likewise, if you know about other people's mental states and what they do and so on, because they tell you it. But if you thought and you believe them because you believe they're trying to tell you the truth, but if you thought that there was no downward action, you wouldn't think that the words that come out of their mouths were caused by their beliefs. Because beliefs can cause things. So generally, unless you're to be totally skeptical, you've got to believe there's a downward causation.
Yeah, that's really good. I love that. One more from this one's from Scott Terry, who just sent in a $50 super chat, which is awesome. He's awesome. He said the evolution of the soul was one of the first philosophy works he ever read. So there's a little tip of the hat to you as well. But Dr. Swinburne, so his question in this one is, what are the implications of your position for models of the Trinity? And I wonder maybe if you could address like the thisness or quiddity or hexade too. Does that have any implications, or did you come to your model of the Trinity in a different way?
Oh dear, that is going to take us a long way, I think, from this. Sure. I think I'd rather not answer that question because I have to go into a lot of things that, you know, we're not talking about today.
Yeah.
But I'm just going to make one short point. that, in my view, the members of the Trinity do not have thisness.
Okay. So does
God
have...
what they are in virtue of their relation to each other. That is to say, the Father is the Father because he is the source of Son and Spirit. The Son is the Son because caused by the Father and not caused by the Spirit. And Spirit is the Spirit because co-caused by the Father and the Son. They are what they are in virtue of their relations. We are not what we are in virtue of our relations. And
yeah.
That is the difference.
Okay. What you said, when you say co-caused, is that procession from the Father and the Son?
Well, it may be. There are different ways in which it is expressed in Western, Eastern Christianity,
yeah.
as you may be aware.
Yeah.
The Western doctrine, which was not in the original creed, but was added by later popes, was that the Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. And the East objected to that being put in the creed, but they're not necessarily against the truth of that doctrine.
Okay, okay.
The Eastern doctrine can be expressed in one of two ways. Either you say that, as it were, the Son and the Spirit are each caused separately by the Father, and that would contradict the Western view, but it's also acceptable in Eastern Christianity to say that the Spirit is caused by the Father through the Son, and that is, seems to me, tantamount to the Western doctrine. And in fact, Aquinas has a discussion of this, and Aquinas and Scotus, they both say that if you put the Eastern doctrine this way, then there is no real difference.
Wow, that's awesome. I'm glad you made that clarification about thisness, because that would seem like a tritheism or something. But if the divine nature has thisness, then that's fantastic. Thanks for so much for addressing that, even though it was off topic. Yeah. Well, Dr. Swinburne, you've been huge. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much for your work. Thank you so much for taking the time to change the audio and get that all figured out. I just want to finish by saying so many of us have really, really appreciated your work, have grown from it, have been able to defend our faiths because of your work, and it continues to have ripple effects throughout the world. So thank you so much for what you do and for doing this as well.
You're very kind. I'm sorry about the initial difficulties, but there we are. I don't understand these machines.
Yeah, me neither. Well, okay. That's going to have to do it, folks. This has been Parker's Pensies, and as always, all glory to God.
Okay, good. Well, thanks.